Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Saigon Guns, a true story of aerial combat in the fall of 1972, by John Thomas Hoffman, narrated by Sean Compton. Foreword. I really hate when someone refers to old people, even though I am probably being very hypocritical as a septuagenarian myself. I must admit that I have used that reference in the past. Being older now myself, I look at the world through very different lenses than in my youth. I first met John Hoffman in 1972 while serving as a 19-year-old AH-1G Cobra pilot for F Troop 8th Air Cavalry. Though we had very different backgrounds, we both ended up in the same place and same time in a war almost 9,000 miles from the United States. As we flew missions together and drank beer together, I developed a close friendship with John and realized we did share one thing very important to both of us, a never-ending love of God, of family, and of country. John had deployed to South Vietnam several months before my arrival and had been assigned to the 203rd Assault Support Helicopter Company, Wildcats, as a Chinook pilot. As a newly minted warrant officer assigned to F Troop, I mostly tried to keep my mouth shut and my ears and eyes open. As I came to know the other pilots of F Troop, I developed a friendship with Captain Arnold Edward Dusty Holm, Jr. Let me state first off that at that point as a new pilot, I did not refer to Captain Holm as Dusty. It would have been like saying, "Hey, babe," to the Queen of England. Others called him Dusty, but I didn't feel I had been in the unit long enough to gain that honor. With the Easter Offensive by North Vietnamese and Russian forces into South Vietnam, things began to get challenging very quickly. This was complicated by the stand-down of several key U.S. Army units in our AO, or Area of Operations, in northern South Vietnam. One result was the stand-down for our supporting CH-47 company, the 203rd AHC. John Hoffman was then transferred to the 48th Assault Helicopter Company, a unit adjacent to F-8 Cavalry on Marble Mountain Army Airfield. The 48th and F-8 Cavalry often participated on operations together. During the month of May and into early June 1972, I began to get my feet on the ground and flew many missions with Captain Holm and one of his close friends, Lieutenant James McQuaid. They both flew the OH-6, Loach, while at that time I was a co-pilot in a Cobra. I developed a deep respect for Captain Holmes' flying ability, but at that time still never called him Dusty. I had heard Captain Holm refer to his friend John Hoffman often while watching him and others play post-mission poker in the hooch. At that time, I never joined in the games. On the evening of June 10th, 1972, I was once again watching the pilots play poker in one of the hooches. Captain Holm was playing along with Lieutenant McQuaid and others. During a lull in the game, Captain Holm looked up at me and asked if I wanted to join the game. I was familiar with the game, as I had played it in college before being expelled for not showing up to classes. I said, "Sure, Captain Holm, I would love to play." To which he replied, "Call me Dusty." I asked what the game was, and Dusty said it was 7-card suicide. When I told them I was not familiar with the game, they quickly said that they would teach me. That was the understatement of the year. $180 later, I still didn't know how to play. The next day, June 11th, 1972, both Captain Holm, Lieutenant McQuaid, and their crews were shot down and killed by enemy fire. Captain Holm was shot down first, and then Lieutenant McQuaid had flown to the crash site to look for survivors. He also was shot down. While this mission was occurring, I was on standby, along with other pilots, at Camp Eagle. To a man, everyone wanted to mount another rescue mission to the two crash sites. Our commanding officer, Major Jack Kennedy, advised that no further missions were to deploy. At that time, there were some really hard feelings about Major Kennedy's decision, but with days, weeks, and months of thinking about it, I realized it was the right one. We had lost two aircraft and crews in the span of 1 hour. We had no backup for further rescue attempts. F Troop was on its own, so we flew back to our base at Marble Mountain and began to grieve and prepare for the next day's missions. With the later deactivation of the 48th Assault Helicopter Company, Captain John Hoffman was reassigned to F Troop, flying the UH-1 Huey as the Blues platoon leader and as air mission commander. John and I became very good friends and have remained so for the past 48 years. John remained in the military to retire as a full colonel. Following my return from South Vietnam, I was assigned to Fort Lewis as a newly promoted W-2, but the Army no longer needed so many helicopter pilots. I soon left the Army and headed back to Houston, Texas. I joined the Houston Police Department, where I served 32 years, 26 of them as a homicide detective. In 2012, John and I, along with our wives, made a trip to France for the 68th anniversary of the D-Day landings on Normandy Beach. On June 6, 2012, as John and I stood atop the cliffs of Pont du Hoc and looked over the edge, we envisioned the 1944 assault by the 2nd Ranger Battalion under the command of Colonel James Rudder. The Rangers had to climb these cliffs under intense fire with a full combat load. John and I both agreed that neither of us could have climbed that cliff when we were 18 years of age, wearing nothing but gym shorts, T-shirt, and tennis shoes, even if Raquel Welch was at the top with two cold beers. Any man who has a military background progresses through his lifetime with multiple opportunities to meet people who are great leaders of men, but they are few and far between. I have had the great honor to have met four during my lifetime. First was my high school football coach, Vernon Ram, a Marine who served in Vietnam. He taught me a little about football and a lot about life. Another was Major Jack Kennedy, commanding officer of F Troop, 8th Air Cavalry Regiment, Republic of South Vietnam, 1972 to 1973. Pilots under his command would land their aircraft on the patio of hell if he asked that it be done. Additionally, Captain Bobby Adams, captain of the Houston Police Homicide Division, covered my ass on many occasions during my career in that division. And finally, Colonel John Hoffman, U.S. Army retired, the author of this book. I flew with him, lived with him, laughed with him, and cried with him. John is probably the most interesting person I have ever met in my life. Enjoy the book. Dwayne D. Shirley, Warrant Officer 2, F Troop, 8th Air Cavalry Regiment, 1972 to 1973, Republic of South Vietnam, Houston Police Department, 1973 to 2006. Preface. I have lived much of my life as a warrior. Not in the tradition of the ancient warrior whose entire being and sole function in life was as a destroyer, but in the tradition of the Washingtonian citizen soldier. I have spent most of my adult life according to a credo long written and observed as an almost holy dedication by many Americans. It is a family tradition going back to the American Revolution, and of my father, my uncles, my cousins, myself, and now my son, born of the necessity to resist that which might threaten what is held sacred, often above the value of home, family, and even life. That credo carried me through a 31-year military career, with service in the United States, Southeast Asia, and Europe, and then numerous long and arduous days in various civil military operations, helping the nation recover from disasters of one sort or another, and recently a stint with the new U.S. Department of Homeland Security, helping to protect this nation from another terrorist attack. No, you need not ask. I indeed do find it hard to say no, a vice that my wife often points out to me. I guess that was how I was made, as the son of a veteran of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. During my time as a civilian in government following the attacks on September 11, 2001, I was asked by a colleague whether my service in South Vietnam still haunts me. I was surprised at his question. He was much younger than I, and he admitted that his understanding of the war in Vietnam came from movies and TV. I was not surprised. Few younger than my generation have direct knowledge of that war or its context. The result is that the current prevailing view of that war is actually a political fiction fostered by the media. He also asked what most often reminded me of my time in Vietnam. I instantly, as always, knew the answer to that question. The smell. I grew up with smells. Our military family lived all over the U.S., from Hawaii and Alaska to Florida, New York and Virginia, and even in post-war Europe. All had unique smells. Some pleasant, some not, but at least most of the time anyway, you got used to them. I recall the strange smells on the World War II battlefields of Europe as a teenager. I remember the World War II veterans on the Normandy beaches talking about the smell of battle. Later, as I worked my way through college as a full-time fireman in Fairfax County, Virginia, I experienced new but unpleasant smells. These smells came from chemical accidents, trash, forest and structure fires, and human bodily fluids and functions and the dead. But the worst by far, at least up until that period of my life, was the smell of burned human flesh. It is a terrible, persistent, and penetrating smell. It does not quickly leave you as most smells do. It stays on your clothes and equipment even after washing, and it hangs in the air and gets on you and stays there. And nothing smells worse. Then I got to Vietnam. Yep, it can be worse. The smell that hit me the day I arrived at Bien Hoa Air Base near Saigon was sudden, overwhelming, and almost like a physical blow to my body. Oh, God, I thought. Is this place covered in dead animals, feces, trash fires, and burning human flesh? My mind raced through the potential sources of the smells filling that noxious air. My dad had warned me, after his two previous tours in South Vietnam, but a spoken warning is not sufficient, I now knew, to prepare you for the shock of that initial exposure. How could anyone live here? Why would they want to live here? And what is worth fighting over in this odorous place? No, I did not get used to that smell. It permeated everything. It was in my underclothes, my jungle fatigues, my flight suits and flight jacket, my survival vest, even, it seemed to me, in the metal of my sidearm. Of course, the insides of our aircraft over there were the same. They all smelled rotten, all of the time. Even years later, after my initial return from South Vietnam, that smell would unexpectedly assault my nose. This happened when I would climb into a helicopter or airplane that had spent any time in Vietnam. My dad and I would discuss that smell often over the years after our service in Vietnam. He and I served there at the same time, in 1971 and 1972. We would both smell something that triggered the recall of that Vietnam wartime stench, or we would simply recall some event or experience in country, and the smell would rush back into our minds unbidden. We both hated the smell and its return to our nose or mind in the years afterwards. But it was there, in an unpleasant life experience that we shared, along with so many other memories of that time. This book will, I hope, convey the reality of service as a U.S. Army combat helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and also dispel some of the myths and falsehoods about the experience of serving in the United States Army in the early 1970s and as a combat helicopter pilot in Vietnam. While my experiences are truly only mine, and I do not pretend to suggest that mine are the same as all others, perhaps my reflections here will help, in some small way, to correct what I have seen incorrectly portrayed across the press and in Hollywood, and to give you a taste of what it was really like to have been there when I was there. I most importantly want to try and give you a sense of how many of us, from a Vietnam warrior's viewpoint, see that experience today. The facts and events narrated here are to the best of my recollection. Any omission and errors here are mine alone, and the opinions I express in the book are mine, and are the result of many years of thoughtful consideration. This book contains the content of contemporaneous notes from my time in the Republic of Vietnam, RVN, letters I wrote and chapter drafts that I began in the early 1980s. It has taken me, working on and off between life events and the health challenges from having served in South Vietnam, decades to complete this book of my experiences as a young military officer and my service in the Republic of South Vietnam. John T. Hoffman, Colonel, U.S. Army, retired. Chapter 1. My Dad Was a Fighter Pilot. As I watched TV news during my junior year in college, I saw the reports of carnage and death in the war in South Vietnam. The quickly evolving helicopter war was becoming a very dangerous place for American soldiers, particularly so for helicopter crews. In 1968, U.S. troop strength peaked at 540,000 in-country, and losses totaled 16,899 U.S. soldiers that year alone. The news reporting was detailed, and images of combat appeared on television nearly every evening. The war was clearly not going in the direction that some in our government were suggesting. Aircraft losses in Vietnam were staggering, with helicopter crews seemingly getting the worst of it. The news reports, I noticed, were focused on two things. First, how many Americans had died, and second, how many helicopters had been shot down the day before. Being a helicopter crewman was seen as one of the most dangerous jobs in the war, but not as dangerous as an infantry soldier or grunt on the ground, slogging through the jungle and rice paddies. I did not want to be a grunt. I watched as friends and acquaintances were drafted. Even firemen in Fairfax were being drafted. There were very few protected jobs that could keep a young man from being drafted. Those of us in college knew that when we graduated, we likely were going to Vietnam, if the war had not ended by then. I had no intention of being an infantry soldier, particularly an enlisted soldier. I wanted a commission as an officer, and by 1968 I realized I would be better off as a pilot. I hoped to be sent, after graduation and commissioning, to the year-long fixed-wing flight school. Staying in college and in Army ROTC, earning that officer's commission was one way to dodge the draft for 4 years. Then another year in flight school, and hopefully it would be all over before I could be sent to Vietnam. It did not work out quite like that. I grew up in the military. As a child, I never lived anywhere more than 4 years before my father was transferred. We lived in Hawaii, Colorado, New York, Alabama, Alaska, Virginia, and France, all before I reached high school. Starting in 1961, I attended the Paris American High School in Garches, France. At the time, I was one of six children of an Air Force officer assigned to EUCOM, the U.S. military command for Europe in the 1960s, located near Paris, France. I grew up around the military and knew many of my father's military friends and associates. I grew up around fighter and bomber pilots, many of whom, like my father, flew in World War II and Korea. My father, a West Point graduate and an Army Air Corps pilot during World War II, shared stories of some of his experiences in that war, but most were stories of humor or unusual experiences flying, or on a very rare occasion, he related a specific mission or event. I also knew he had some involvement in the Korean War, but he always said it was very peripheral. Growing up on or near military bases gave me some knowledge about the military, its organization, and the basic history of World War II. My father had flown in the Pacific Theater and had not been involved in military operations in the European Theater of Operations, ETO. I did have a distant British uncle, E4 Davis, who was a Battle of Britain pilot, and I had heard some stories from his perspective, but nothing about operations over Normandy and D-Day itself. Living in post-war Europe so soon after the end of World War II, where the destruction of that war was still all around where we lived, quickly brought me an understanding of the impact of war on the people who suffered through it and those who fought it. Early in my freshman year at the Paris American High School, word passed quickly through the U.S. military and dependent community in Paris that a new movie about D-Day was to be filmed in Normandy. A few weeks later, all students were asked to come to the auditorium after class. A Mr. Zanuck was introduced. He informed us that he was going to film a movie in Normandy, just an hour's drive north of our location, and he needed extras for scenes to be filmed on the weekends. There would be no pay, but we would learn a lot about movies, about D-Day itself, and we might just meet a few movie stars. Then he explained that they only needed boys for these scenes. What followed on weekend trips to Normandy, scattered over the next few months, was an amazing introduction into film and documentary making. But most important to me was the grim, often horrific first-person history I learned from those who had landed on those beaches and drop zones on that incredible and bloody June 5th through 6th, 1944, on the Normandy coast of France. We met and listened to the stories of paratroopers, infantry soldiers, and the airmen who had actually participated in the June 6th, 1944 Allied invasion of France. The stories were both fascinating and horrifying to a 14-year-old. We watched scenes being filmed, and on two occasions stood in as soldiers on the beach in some of the long shots were filmed as background scenes for the movie. It was fascinating to be present for filming, even if at some distance, when John Wayne was in the scene, or on the beach when Sean Connery did one of his comic scenes in the movie as a British soldier. Of particular interest was at the filming of the action at Pegasus Bridge. Here we listened to actor and D-Day veteran Richard Todd, who in the movie played his commander, Major John Howard, relate the facts of the actual battle and his own personal experiences that day at Pegasus Bridge. All the Hollywood actors, the current British and American soldiers playing the previous generation in the movie, and we young onlookers stood in awe listening to his recounting of the actual operation that terrifying day. Even Sean Connery stood listening intently during one session. Of course, true to his British television character at the time, however, it was not long before he was telling humorous one-liners to those around him, British, American, and German. I, like many others present, came away with a new respect for what a hero is and what the price of courage is on the battlefield. I hoped I would never, ever be called upon to fight in a war. During the filming of another small part in the movie, I witnessed the recreation of an event from the German Army perspective. While I did not see the full recreation of the event until the movie was released, I did overhear the translated, first-hand account of a former German officer who had been in the bunker. He recounted the experience and described his fear upon seeing the massive extent and scale of the Allied fleet coming over the horizon directly toward his position, and the ensuing bombardment of his portion of the German defense line. It was clearly a very frightening experience for him, and his retelling of the experience left a strong impression on me. What it must have been like for soldiers on either side of the battle that day. What a frightening, nerve-shattering, and debilitating thing to find yourself amid such chaos and violence. How did any of the soldiers that day focus on their duty or function, whether attacker or defender? How does one overcome such paralyzing fear? During this period, my father decided that my brother and I should see some of the horrors left over from World War I and World War II firsthand. We visited World War I battlefields and graveyards. We saw the bones at Chateau Thierry, and we saw the trench of bayonets at Verdun, and the church where hundreds and hundreds of skeletons of World War I soldiers are interred behind glass. We visited World War II battlefields and the American cemeteries in northern France, including the one above Omaha Beach where Dad took us to the graves of members of his West Point class of 1944 who died in the ETO after D-Day. It was very moving for Dad, my brother Kip, and me. We went up to the top of the cliffs at Pont du Hoc and stood in fear and awe as we looked down and saw the extent of the obstacles that the Rangers had faced when they assaulted the dug-in Germans at the top. I recall that my palms began to sweat as I looked down. It made the war and its impact even more real to my brother and me. Some weeks later, our father took us to the concentration camp at Dachau, just north of Munich, West Germany. He took us through the dormitory buildings and walked us along the fences, under the guard towers, and through the killing fields below them. He took us into a crematorium where skulls and bones were still laying where they were partially buried in the open ovens. This was 1961, and the stench of burned flesh was still overwhelming, as little had yet been cleaned up in this part of the camp. Even at my young age, the inhumanity I saw was mind-numbing. I was stunned, and my brother and I both ran out and got sick. There were buckets outside the doors, expressly placed there for this reason. I asked a camp guide outside why things were still left in there as they were when the camp was liberated. He said in accented English that it is so because we must never forget. My father then told us that the U.S. Military Occupation Command still required that such camps were maintained as they were by the local German government, and that local Germans were encouraged to tour the camps. When The Longest Day movie premiered in Paris in 1962, we attended one of several premiere showings at Paris theaters. During that showing, there was little noise in the theater from the audience. All sat in complete but intent silence. No one spoke. No comments were heard. The audience had moved into some sort of numbed state. Everyone, including us young American students, were completely engaged. We young extras had only seen brief glimpses of portions of scenes during filming and had no idea as to what the final film would look like. The first-hand accounts of those who were there on June 6, 1944, were knotted in the movie into an irresistible, engaging, and moving whole. For the many in the audience, our dad explained after the showing, they were reliving their own war experience and the promise of liberation that the horrors of D-Day portended. We had all just witnessed an amazing documentary production so complex and expensive that it nearly financially broke Daryl Zanuck. When the movie ended and the credits rolled, most sat in silence at first. Then slowly the applause began and grew. Then this mainly French audience stood up and clapped and clapped. This incredible, comprehensive, yet still incomplete retelling of the events.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?